Welcome to the podcast for empathy and imagination. My name is Aubrey.
And I am Drew. Welcome.
Thanks for being here with us. This is the show where we learn to empathize and imagine with all of the problems. Life's problems. Try to create a better future through empathy and imagination. Thanks for joining us. We will have a question for you at the end of the episode, so stay tuned. All right. We just had a couple other couple episodes come out. The Alex Milankovic sessions.
Sounded good. I listened to that and I thought I sounded a little strange.
Stranger than usual?
Yeah, I listened to it. I sounded really groggy, and I thought I was maybe becoming intoxicated.
I remember you were getting sick.
Yeah, and then I realized that was also happening.
Yeah.
It was interesting.
Because I was sick, and I think I gave you whatever you got.
I forgive you.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't apologizing.
Okay, so yeah, I'd like
sorry
to...
Sorry about that.
It's great. I'd like to check in. So how are we doing? How was your week? How was your day so far?
Week was good. Busy editing the episodes. Today was good. Just running errands on my bike. And it's finally sunny out, so that was cool.
Nice.
Yeah. My bike's pretty thrashed, though. I need to get, I have a checklist of equipment that's just falling apart.
Yeah, I can empathize with that.
Yeah.
As we just finished a big bike journey marathon. A lot of things are squeaky and wobbly at the at this point on the bike.
What was the marathon? Did we mention that?
I think so.
2,000 miles in 2015.
2,000 miles.
Not in one day.
No, we would that wouldn't work. Instead, we went camping 9 times, went over 10,000 feet, and 2,000 miles.
How was your week?
You know, it's been very interesting. Still on the same project, working on opening Gradient, the Conscious Craft beer bar. It's a very much of a roller coaster where, like, 2 steps forward, 2 steps back, 1 step forward, 3 steps forward, 1 step back.
No consistency to the progress?
There's
kind of forward progress.
Kind of forward progress. That is a consistent thing to notice. There is forward progress. And it's definitely new and challenging. But we're getting closer. It appears as if that it still seems possible. And one of the main hurdles to overcome is coming in early February. So my week has been, I'm not doing that much, but doing little things that are needed for that thing and life. So I found, one of the things that in my week that went is I found that I wanted some sort of schedule. I thought it'd be cool just to not have anything scheduled, but it turns out that that makes me uncomfortable and that I was found myself missing some sort of schedule. Yeah. So that's basically how my week was.
Cool. So a lot of, a lot of bureaucracy that you've been dealing with.
Yeah. There's, it's really like, it's unimaginable for anybody who has tried to start a business. You know what I'm talking about. And for those who haven't tried to start a business, it's insane. It's insane. You have to, everyone's going to tell you no. And then you're going to go ask someone else and they're going to tell you no. And then you have to just keep pushing until the answers stop being no. Basically, that's how you do it. You break through the barriers that exist. Yeah. Capitalism has...
Sounds like a lot of energy.
Yes. You must be committed. Capitalism has, I think, a lot of stock in wanting to make it challenging to make money that then would have you in a certain other sort of social position. However weird that sounds, it's like, it seems like there's like qualifications and trials of what you're willing to go through, and then you can own a business per se. Once you own a business, then you have more say in the community. You can like do stuff, hire people.
So there's no incentives right out of the gate. Like, I mean, it's kind of a long con, right? Because you're you're sacrificing a lot now for a later potential future.
True. If I can do this, I'll be a 50% owner without debt right away. And I'll have to buy, oh, I'll get to buy 50% of the company back from my partner.
Mm-hmm.
So then, yeah. So like work now, no money, literally $0 of any kind. And then in like 5 years, it would be a reasonable income.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
That's pretty cool.
You know, we'll know soon if it's going to happen or not. There'll be a really deciding factor here in early February.
Hmm. So a lot of lengthy phone calls?
There are lengthy phone calls. There are lengthy emails. There are short emails. Like one of the important emails we had, we wrote this very long, detailed thing, making a request, and there was a one-word response, just one word, yes. And it's
capitalized?
No. All lowercase.
Okay. No period afterwards?
There was maybe a period. Maybe.
Hmm. Nice of them to put the period in.
Yeah. You know, they're nice folks.
Yeah. They said yes.
They did say yes. So I moved closer. We moved closer.
Cool. You know when you have to call like T-Mobile or AT&T or something?
Mm-hmm.
You have to do like one of those long phone calls where you have to wait on the... on hold.
Mm-hmm.
A good little thing that you reward yourself each time you do that.
Hmm.
And you take turns, like one person does it and the other person does it. And, you put in like $1, let's say, to a jar.
Hmm.
So after a year you have, you know, enough for a pizza.
Hmm.
You order a pizza. Thanks T-Mobile. Thanks AT&T.
Thanks bureaucracy.
Yeah.
That's a nice way of being imaginative, thinking about some of the troubles we have. It's like, I was thinking about, actually, my partner, Rebecca, was on the phone earlier on a long hold, very annoying song thing. I was thinking, like, what could you be doing and still be able to, like, not miss them going, excuse me, are you still on the line? No, beep.
Yeah.
Something fun. I wonder if there's a...
Some places,
ideas.
Yeah, some places do the thing where you call them and you submit, you log a ticket. You know, when it comes up, they just give you a call. They don't leave you on hold. They just call you back.
What if they had a like a game where you like called and when you were on hold, like you would like play a trivia game or something like that.
Mm.
And maybe if you did well, you got
Keno. Yeah, you're playing Keno while you wait.
Oh.
What are we doing today, Drew?
Well, today we're having a guest. We have a special guest, Rebecca Ainsworth. We have some fun topics we want to talk to you lovely folks about. And we also have a question at the end of this. Let's go and have our guest here. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the lovely, brilliant, talented, beautiful... Rebecca Ainsworth.
Oh, hi guys.
Hi, how you doing?
You scooting a little bit closer to that microphone there. I can't hear you.
Can you hear yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can hear myself.
Oh, there, now we can. Now I can hear you. Nice. Okay, cool. So, you're really cool, and a lot of people know that. And I'm wondering if you could help us out.
Happily.
Okay, great. So I think it was our first podcast episode that you were hanging around here, listening to and overheard a little, and I think I felt some desire to share, and I really want to give you that opportunity to talk about the concept of Saturn return, about the basics into the in-depth into maybe if you feel like some of your experience. And I think with your... you calling yourself a witch and your skills in herbal creation and thoughtful intention. I'm curious to hear your story about that.
Awesome. Thanks. Well, I definitely want to start by saying in a kind of disclaimer, I am not by any means an advanced astrologer. The whole, that whole world is very, it goes very deep, and there are a lot of people who I'm sure have more expert opinion on Saturn Return than I. But my personal understanding of Saturn Return, like what that scientifically means, is, you know, for most people, when they check their horoscope in the newspaper or online, I guess people don't read newspapers anymore, do they?
No.
I don't know what that is. What's a newspaper?
So when you check your horoscope on Facebook or whatever it is, it's just based on your sun sign. And
which is not the full picture?
No, it's such a small part of the... It's like 10% of the picture.
How many signs are there per person, say, in an average school of thought?
I believe there are 12 signs total.
Oh, that would make some sense. I mean, but...
I might be embarrassing myself as we speak, though. It might be 13. I don't recall.
Say I was born April 29th, 1983, at about 6 a.m. One could derive about 12... descriptors of that birth time?
No.
Oh, thanks for clarifying.
Yeah. So, as I was saying,
the sun sign is one of the descriptors.
Right. But when, if one were to be more curious about their horoscope than just reading something online, like, oh, your daily horoscope is this, you could go to an astrologer, which I've done, and what they will do, if they're worth their fee they're charging you, is give you a whole chart. And there's lots of terms like how there's like at least 8 houses, maybe more. There's your rising, there's descending, there's your sun sign, there's your moon sign. And then all of these different interact with one another. So some complement one another, some are in conflict with one another, and there's like lots of really interesting terminology that I don't really understand, like quincuscent, and there's something called a yod. And anyways, so that's maybe for another guest to explain more in depth. But
the rising sign and
right.
All that stuff.
But what all that is referring to is what the night sky looked like, or what the sky looked like, because it doesn't necessarily have to be at night if you're born during the day, but the stars are there regardless if the sun is shining.
That's
or not.
True.
Yeah.
They're there.
Right,
they're there. So your whole chart is based off of where you were and what time you were born and what stars were over you, what stars were in the heaven, and planets were in the heaven when you were born. Mm-hmm. And that the arrangement of the planets as they were the minute you were born, where you were born, if you believe in astrology, determines a lot about the kind of person that you are and the kind of struggles you're going to have in your life, and ways in which you maybe have some feathers in your cap. And Saturn, which is, Saturn in Roman mythology is the equivalent of Zeus, who's like father figure. That's the kind of symbolism that goes along with the archetype of Saturn. And it takes about 28 years for Saturn to go back to the same place in the sky that it was when you were born. It takes about that amount of time. And so the belief is that when people are around their late 27, early 28, maybe even as far as 29, and Saturn is returning to their chart, their home chart, if you will, their birth chart, what happens is Saturn's kind of like this harbinger of everything that you have put out into the world thus far kind of comes back for review. It's like, what have you been saying you're committed to? What have you been saying you're interested in? What have you been avoiding and saying you don't want to look at? here it all is, all the cards on the table in front of you. What do you want to do with them? And it's oftentimes a pretty confronting time for people. I know my Saturn return was very confronting. My whole world kind of fell apart, and then I had the opportunity to rebuild it. And another belief is that if the lessons that Saturn return presents to you aren't heeded, you have another opportunity later on to kind of take another pass at it, which we like to call midlife crisis. Because if it takes about 28 to 29 years for Saturn to come back around,
right,
it's like right before 60, it happens all over again.
Concerned about stuff.
Yeah.
A re-return?
A re-return. Exactly.
Yeah. Huh.
Yeah. All sorts of ways to make a fool of yourself.
So I guess we have three or four chances to shed our skin and rebuild.
Four would be really something.
You know, if the technology makes it possible.
But can you imagine the Saturn return of, like, you know,
129?
Or like 88. Like, do we, I mean, I wonder if that's something talked about where, like, people who are about 90 years old kind of have this other sort of, like, time in their lives where they realize that there's, you know, the same thing. I wonder.
I wonder, too.
And then also, again, when you're, like, 125 or something.
Right. That would be interesting.
I think technology will do that. But
yeah. Extend the lifespan?
I'd like to think that that will happen in my lifetime in such a way that it's actually accessible to me as somebody who doesn't imagine that I will be incredibly well off in my life. Having that just be like easily accessible for most people, that sounds pretty cool. I think you're more optimistic about that than I.
Well, I am. I've been called as such before.
Well, if you could live forever, how long would you want to live?
I think I'd want to live long time, but I don't know if it was forever. I don't know. That's a whole different conversation, I think. I imagine that we will live to see technology carry people closer to 200 years in our lifetimes, maybe including us, maybe not. That's all kind of the scale, you know.
If I had access, I mean, I can't really know how I would feel about it, but in imagining it, if I had access to that choice, I think I would want to stick around for as long as it was like useful to do so, as long as I felt useful.
Like if your mind or body withered to where you couldn't contribute anymore, that'd be a bummer.
Yeah, if the only thing left was, okay, another day of figuring out how to pass the time. That's like,
right.
Entertainment isn't enough of a reason to keep going.
I can imagine, much like in a universe like in Star Trek Next Generation, there's probably always new things to contribute to. I would imagine that's like a constant like imagination.
But you know, in the land of speculation, we can only assume that after being alive for 500 years, you know, it's your 500th birthday, it's the day after, and you just finished some major project, and it's like, are you really gonna have the energy and the capacity and the desire to, like, okay, what's next? To keep asking the question, what's next? I don't know.
As long as there was something worthwhile to pursue, then, yeah. Why wouldn't you want to live?
Right? I think there will be. I think technology will carry us into what we couldn't possibly imagine. Like, if you were to talk to somebody in the 1950s about iPhones, they'd be like, no. But if you were to extrapolate now to 66 years from now, it's exponential increase of technology from as it goes on. So what we could, when we're 80, 90, there's no way we could imagine that now.
That's true.
No way.
You know, upon thinking about it, like, the thought of extending my life definitely sounds cool, but I don't think I would choose eternal life if that was an option in front of me. I think I believe that death is a really necessary part of the human experience. And
yeah,
you know, in that conversation of like, what would be the next interesting, useful adventure to embark on, I would say there comes a time where death is that next useful
right
adventure to take
final project.
Yeah, my Saturn really took me to my knees. And
were you living in California at that time?
I was living in California, and you know, I'd spent my 20s, really that whole decade, choosing relationships that really obviously didn't serve me. And then relating to those poor choices.
Relating to those poor choices.
In a very unconscious way. And by unconscious, I mean like really unaware of how much harder I was making it on myself.
Yeah, you've exacerbated the situation?
Very much so.
By what? Not being aware of what was happening?
Just a lot of like the equivalent of trying to go to like, let's say I really want some bread. Like, I'm really hungry for some bread. Mm-hmm. And I need it. Like, the bread has this vitamin in it that's essential to my well-being in my life. Mm-hmm. And I go to a hardware store. And I go to a clerk and I'm like, wow, I just really need some bread. And the clerk makes it very obvious that they just don't have bread in this store. It's not there. This is not a store for bread. We have hammers, we have screwdrivers, and I can't hear it. I'm just like, surely there must be bread here. I'm sure that there's bread here. So I start wandering the aisles, convinced that there's bread somewhere and that the clerk is just misinformed or confused. And I start calling out for bread. And to the point where I'm so desperate for bread, for sustenance, I like try to snack on the handle of a hammer. Like, maybe this will tide me over till I find the bread. And it's for some reason it made more sense to my brain to try and make consuming a hammer this will work for now, than walk out of the store and go find a bakery.
You were trying to turn lead into gold somehow?
Something like that.
You know, maybe the person who was working there at the store, if they brought their lunch and they brought a sandwich, there might have been bread in that store.
But
well, if there was, they weren't
giving
it
up. There wasn't enough to share.
Maybe they had already eaten.
Yeah.
And then there were some clerks, you know, because I played this scenario out many times over, and there were some clerks that were like, "Oh, I think there is some bread here. I love bread." I love bread too. Like, maybe we can find some bread here together.
It's a good image.
Extended metaphor.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah. So yeah, I really hit a rock bottom right around 28 and made some really different choices in my life. And got some help. I got some help. And
what was that help?
I got into therapy, which I'd never done before. it was a very humbling experience for me. And I have found that humbling experiences are really good for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't that the truth?
Being, what is it, humiliated is not all bad because you learn humility. Right?
Yeah.
Isn't that the truth?
So, sorry, were you done with that thought?
Well, I also, I got into 12-step. I got into a 12-step program.
Mm.
And that also I found really, really helpful. Really gave me some tools to recognize when I'm kind of unconsciously reacting to my life instead of responding to my life. And what I've learned is the only difference is reacting is just an unconscious, it's like you're being controlled by the emotions that are being evoked by whatever's challenging about the experience. And responding can only happen once the emotional experience has been noticed and acknowledged. And once that space is created, then an actual response can be made. I'm really grateful for that. Really changed my life.
That sounds excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really what brought you into my life, Drew.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's been interesting being in relationship with you, and feels like, well, there's many things that are interesting about it, but the thing that I'll share right now in relation to this whole Saturn conversation is it's like I had such a degree, a high degree of drama and chaos and heartache in my life. It was so normalized. It was like a really high-pitched tone that was like grating, that was just constantly there. And I will frequently, when I'm going about my day, like notice, like, it's not there. Like, I still have things that cause me heartache in my life, but it's almost like, wow, but it's nothing compared to what it was like to have that just be constantly normal.
Yeah.
The desperate search for bread.
Extreme situation had become normal.
Yeah.
So if Saturn is the harbinger, other planets also return. Do they have similar sway or properties or distinctive characteristics
Absolutely.
That influence lives?
Yeah, they do. The one that's more, like the two references that are more popular, at least in the Bay Area, I don't know if it would count, I don't know about other areas of the nation, but...
Or our international listeners.
Right, or the international listeners, of course.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. Our Saturn return and Mercury retrograde. People talk a lot about Mercury retrograde. It happens 4 times a year, maybe more. Maybe it's like 6 times a year. Again, I am not an astrologer.
That's just, it's common, though.
It's common.
Mercury's faster than Saturn.
Right.
It's closer to.
Yeah, and it... I know even less about the science of what that term means, but it's something about its orbit that makes it appear as if it's going backwards for a period of time, and that's what the retrograde is.
Yeah, it's because of where the orbits are. It does a little loop
right
in the sky.
Right, so the belief about around Mercury retrograde is that it's a time, it's a time of introspection. Mercury is related to who is the god with the winged feet?
Hermes?
I think so.
I think that's Hermes.
Yeah, Hermes. Yep. So yeah, he's the god of communication. He's the ruler of Gemini. I'm a Gemini.
Huh.
Intellect and the element that he goes along with his air. I think of him as like having a VIP pass to all the worlds. So he doesn't have his own realm, but he has access to the kingdom of the gods. He has access to the kingdom of the dead. He can really go anywhere.
That's cool.
It's an introspective time.
So yeah, so when Mercury is in retrograde, it's a time for reflection. Hmm. It's not a great time for decision making. And the belief is that there's a likelihood that technology is going to be adversely affected.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
Yeah.
Oh, Mercury's in retrograde.
Right.
That's why the computer's acting up.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I feel like clearly everyone has the freedom to believe in it to whatever degree feels good to them.
Yeah.
Could you possibly summarize now what you've talked about Saturn return?
Saturn return is when Saturn comes back into your chart after having been gone for something around 28 years to ask you, what do you actually want and what have you been avoiding? And if you have been avoiding a lot, it's fair to expect a challenging
hefty thwap.
Challenging time. Yeah.
So if you could somehow accelerate time, you could experience more Saturn returns. So maybe once we crack the speed of light, we can start controlling our own astronomical destinies.
Wow.
Wouldn't that be something?
That would be something.
That would be something. Final Corp. It'll be fine. Finally. There's a corporation looking out for its best needs. Final Corp. It'll be fine.
Thanks, Final Corp, for sponsoring the episode and supporting the show. Thanks for the free mayonnaise that you guys sent us last week.
The misters you sent us.
Misters.
Yeah. If you don't know, they clamp on to the male genitalia, and then when you urinate, you can spray a mist instead of a stream. And it is convenient in
very
so
convenient.
Many ways, because like when you're golfing, you can just pee as you're walking and it'll just mist. Like, or at festivals, no one can tell it's hot, you know.
Yeah, or so if you want to take a shower on the go.
It's a urine shower, but
drink a lot of water and urinate in the general direction of your face.
Wouldn't it be cool if you could combine the mayonnaise and the mister and make a mayonnaise mister?
Oof. Well, I mean,
salads.
I mean, there is naze.
Hell yeah. You know, I'm going to pitch that to Final Corp in the next.
What are you pitching to him?
Our next meeting.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a great idea, Rebecca. And I'm going to steal it and then make all the money off it. Mayonnaise mistered, a spray bottle of
so you can,
mayonnaise.
Mist your salads with mayonnaise.
Yeah. You can't even see that it's there. You
put it on your face.
Moisturizer.
It's like a mayonnaise dew. Not to be confused with Mountain Dew. That's
a different.
Final Corp's version of Mountain Dew is called Naze. That's apostrophe N-A-Z-E.
What is Naze? We're almost done with the promo, folks. Hang on.
We'll talk. I don't think we're authorized to talk about Naze.
Oh, we're
episode.
Not? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then let's finish the promo there and move on with the show.
Thanks, Final Corp.
Thanks, Final Corp. Okay, folks.
Thanks, guys, for listening.
Thanks for your patience. We're getting through the ads there. So we're here with Rebecca Ainsworth for the podcast for Empathy and Imagination. And we're moving on to the next major question. And that is, and it's more generalized. It's like, I want to talk about what you mean when you call yourself a witch. And like, what isn't today a special day?
Well, today's not on the Wiccan calendar.
Interesting.
But in a couple days, there'll be a special day.
So it's coming up really soon.
It's coming up really soon.
Well, let's talk about that.
Okay.
So you identify as a quote-unquote witch.
I do.
Is that derogatory if I said that? Or is that just being accurate?
That's accurate.
Okay.
It's accurate.
I guess it's been demonized, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the original way to insult and not just insult, but
vilify and defame someone.
Yeah, vilify discredit and defame. Them. Thank you.
Discredit.
Thank you. Nice telepathic catch there.
I just, it was your sentence.
Yeah, I do call myself a witch. It's a fairly new title that I've taken on. I was like enamored with the occult as a young person. I've always romanticized fantasy and was really into fairies as a kid. And
any Dungeons and Dragons?
You know, I didn't play any Dungeons and Dragons. I probably would have if someone in my life had been like, look, we're playing this game. It's awesome. Here we go. I would have been like, okay.
You can still choose to play.
I could. Yeah. I could choose that. That's true.
Maybe your next Saturn return.
Maybe. Oh, man. Maybe. You know, after high school, my intention on anything occult-like kind of faded. And it came up again a couple years ago. A friend of mine asked me to join her at a Elements of Magic class hosted by a, I don't know if I'd call them an organization, but they're a branch, if you will, a Wiccan community in the Bay Area called Reclaiming. I believe Reclaiming was founded by a woman named Starhawk in the 70s, and she's considered kind of one of the names.
She's written some books, right?
She's written some books.
I've seen that name.
Yeah, around. She's written some books. And there's many different branches of Wiccanism. And I'm not the person who knows what all those branches are and the history and the lineage. But Reclaiming was my access point. And I took a class with a friend and was curious enough after the class was over to keep going. And after taking a couple more classes, I decided to go with a different faction of Wiccanism called Dianic Wiccanism.
Dianic?
Dianic, which is more feminine focused. And Dianic Wiccanism has been kind of a controversial topic in the Bay Area specifically over the past, I don't know, at least 20 years, definitely the last 10, because gender identity politics are so intensely debated and contested in this area. Having a religion really focused on the feminine and what that means, it's just, it's been an issue. So it's been interesting being a part of it as someone who identifies as queer and has been involved with the queer community to choose this route. When some of the people who founded this version of Wiccanism were very anti, have been and still are anti-transsexual, women.
So there are different groups within Wiccanism. How do you say? Do you say Wiccanism?
I suppose. Wiccanism, paganism.
Paganism. So there are different groups and there are there kind of strife within the groups?
Yes. Like you were just describing? There has been. There's been strife in politics and we live in a pretty political area. So I make up it's like especially so in the Bay.
Yeah, everything is politicized here.
Yeah. The reason I decided to go with the teacher that I chose was because she's been practicing for a long time, and her name is Carolyn Hunt, and she has a history of being very involved in the gay and queer community, and I felt confident that she would be able to bring kind of a new perspective and a new wave approach to Dianic Wiccanism, and that it wouldn't be the more traditional, like, women born women, which is kind of a crappy way to say, like, vagina only, real parentheses, vagina only.
In the traditional, in traditional paganism?
Dianic Wiccanism.
Oh, Dianic. Oh, I see.
Yeah. Hmm. So anyways, I am about to finish a apprenticeship that I've been in for the past year. The training is called A Year and a Day. And my ceremony will be held on Imbolc, which is one of the classic Wiccan holidays. And there's eight, actually. There's eight major holidays in the Wiccan calendar. And they match up with the equinoxes and the solstices. And then it's called cross quarters. So in between each equinox and solstice, there's a holiday.
Is that what's coming up?
That's what's coming up February 2nd. And much in the same way that a lot of the secular American Christmas traditions pull from older pagan solstice celebrations, like decorating the tree and all sorts of things. Our New Year's resolutions kind of comes from Imbolc, which is about making a pledge to the goddess for the coming year. Like, what is your pledge for the year? So the solstice is called Yule. And then in between the solstice and spring equinox is Imbolc, February 2nd. It's also known as Candlemas. And it's like celebrating pre-spring.
Now, what's the... How did this come about, paganism?
How did this, or
specifically Wiccan? Is it an outgrowth of paganism, or is was there a founder, so to speak? I'm completely ignorant of it.
So sure.
Any information you have would be illuminating.
Sure. And again, there are people who have way a better grasp of the history than I do. But what I can share of my knowledge of it is... the belief is that way back in the day, there were a lot of cultures that were matriarchal and worshipped goddesses.
Mm-hmm.
Over the past, basically in the like 50s of the past century, there was a kind of reawakening of those traditions. And the challenging thing about it is there isn't like hard historical data that can be referenced. Whether it's a new age religion that likes to think of itself as based on something that happened back in the day, or is actually taking old traditions and old histories and reimagining them, that's all kind of a gray area.
Mm-hmm. Would you call it a gradient?
Sure, I'd call it a gradient.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, and My experience with Wiccanism and calling myself a witch is like, for me, as someone who has been exposed to a lot of different kinds of metaphysical, I don't really enjoy this term, but it seems useful in this conversation, like new agey concepts and methodologies and religions. For me, Wiccanism really fits in well with all of that. For me, the word spell might as well be synonymous with the word prayer. is synonymous with the word intention.
A wish.
Right.
Hmm.
Right. And so the way it's most easily applicable for me in my life is not really thinking of it as I'm going to use my will or my thoughts or some ineffable power I have to alter the physical arrangement of this table or alter what's happening on that person's face over there, or like the ways in which the occult is most often dramatized in popular culture. And there are definitely mystery schools and factions of paganism and Wiccanism that dive into the more using your consciousness to alter reality. And that's not yet been an access point for me. When I do spells, they're just a way to focus my energy in a way. It's just really a prayer. It's a way to focus my energy in a way that's intentional and solemn and ritualizing it just gives it this shape and accessibility that I appreciate.
You can make anything sacred, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of what I take away from it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my favorite
part
of this whole journey has been really embracing ritual in my life. Really, really embracing it. And also really embracing, for me, oftentimes when inspiration on something, some philosophical thing hits me, or some realization about relationships or what have you, like earlier in our talk, mm-hmm. comes in the form of an analogy that really works well for me. And one thing I've been appreciating through my experience with Wiccanism is learning trance work, which is basically visualization. But like, for example, one thing I'm working on right now, actually, I've heard it said kind of in many different schools that when we as people try to manipulate others or say one thing when we mean another, it's called a hook. Like I'm trying to hook you to get you to do what I want or give me what I want without actually having to say what it is that I'm doing. I'm like trying to get you to do it without realizing that I'm trying to get you to do it. So expanding on the imagery of a hook,
mm-hmm.
I've been working on,
it's a good metaphor,
doing trance work with like, okay, visualizing what does that hook look like? Like what qualities or attributes are, like, how big is the hook? How is it shaped? When do I use it? And how do I retract it? How do I, like, basically trying to create imagery around difficult things that I deal with in my daily waking life, with the hope that by creating some imagery and kind of workshopping it out in a theatrical way, I can better equip myself to move through my life in a way that I actually want to, that's in keeping with my higher self.
Take arms against the sea of troubles. I think metaphors are definitely important, and some people maintain that language is pure metaphor, right? Because you have the word tree. It's really a metaphor for a placeholder symbol, which is the tree itself, but it doesn't refer to a specific tree unless you say the tree. But if you say a tree, it's a metaphor for what we know as a tree. So each word is actually a metaphor.
I like that.
Yeah.
It goes further to say that, you know, we try to express something. There's a thing we're trying to express. There's a thing that we did express, and there's a thing that was received.
Perception of the message is almost out of your control, right? Mm. There's some variables there. Even if you say exactly what you mean and are concise, perception can follow that up.
True.
Oh.
Or interpretation.
I have one more thing I'd love to share about my experience of being a witch. There's many different pantheons of gods and goddesses that Wiccans and pagans worship. And again, there's a whole another realm of political appropriateness in, for example, a white person worshiping like a god or goddess from a diaspora that is from a country that they aren't from or they don't know really anything about or the culture. That's a topic that comes up in this area for sure. Mm-hmm. The pantheon that I feel that really resonates with me and I feel comfortable with, it feels culturally appropriate-ish, is the Greco-Roman pantheon.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think of worshiping the goddess, it's...
a particular one?
Well, there's lots of goddesses that really resonate with me. And I don't think of them, like philosophically, I don't think of them as entities out there that I'm trying to communicate with. I think of them more as archetypes that are versions of the divine. I experience the divine as a pretty malleable force. And I feel like archetypes are one of the ways that we see the face of God and experience the face of God and are the face of God. It's like, I feel like we pass through different and embody different archetypes often throughout the day. I think we interchange them often. And when I worship Diana or I worship Hecate when I worship Bridget, I feel like I'm talking with the divine through this particular form. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think that if, you know, I mean, those
yes.
Greco-Roman characters or gods and goddesses were created, I think, because people act that way. And so the gods aren't without. They aren't somewhere out there. The gods are actually within, and that's how these religions and all their gods and goddesses come about, is because it's essentially like an imaginative history of human nature,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Of a given era.
Of a given era. And somehow Shakespeare was able to conjure up things with the same power as, you know, the entirety of Greco-Roman religious history.
Mm.
He was able to come up with stories that were equally as compelling.
Yeah, my hands actually have tattoos of symbols that tie in both of the topics we've been in today, astrology and paganism. I have astrological symbols tattooed on my hands. I have Mercury, I have Chiron, I have Vesta, and I have Juno. And they all have significance astrologically in my chart. But the main reason I got them is for the archetypes that they symbolize and how those roles really resonate in my life.
Hmm.
Mercury is the traveler. Chiron is considered the wounded healer.
C-H-A-R-O-N?
C-H-I-R-O-N, yeah.
Okay. That's a moon of Pluto, right?
Something like that. I think it's an asteroid.
I've heard it pronounced Karen, too.
So he's the wounded healer or shaman.
Okay.
And Vesta is the keeper of the flame. She's a priestess. And Juno is the queen of heaven and the wife. Wife of Zeus.
Cool. And Jupiter Hercules? Is that how that... is that the equivalent?
I don't think so. I think Jupiter is Apollo, actually.
Okay. Cool beans.
Yeah, I don't think Hercules is in the pantheon astrologically.
Right. Cool.
Would you enjoy creating like a summary paragraph about you being a witch?
I can try.
Give it a zing.
Sure. Being a witch is currently my version of being in the larger philosophical community of New Age metaphysical thought, of your experience as a reflection of your thoughts and your intentions. And for me, Wiccanism is, it like takes that concept and gives it a little more flair and theatrical participation and ritualizes it in a way that really speaks to me. And I appreciate, I experience Wiccanism as an access point to reverence and also as an access point to playfulness, which I don't really feel like we're taught how to do in this country as adults. It's like being silly is like,
it's frowned upon.
It's frowned upon.
After a certain age. Yeah.
Yeah. It was really hard for me in our first class. I was like, oh God, this is so one of those weirdo people. Dang it. It was challenging and it was really good for me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Nice.
Thanks guys. Nice.
Do you have any topics of your own, Rebecca?
Anything that would be fun to apply empathy and imagination to?
Yeah, I was actually thinking of that. I feel like a lot of what we've talked about today has more on the imagination side. I guess my question for you guys is... How do you use empathy in your daily life? Like, especially, like, in conflict resolution?
That's a good question.
I don't know. Approach the situation with patience. And it's kind of a cliche, but try to put yourself in their shoes. And, you know, try to put your eyeballs into their eyeballs and your brain into their brain and find out where they're coming from and not take anything personally, maybe, so that you can have the strength to meet the situation with calmness. Maybe one way to do it.
Where do you find the willingness... to give, because I feel like I make up that for a lot of people. I know I've had times in my life when I've felt this way, like giving somebody else the gift of my empathy, which almost feels like it flows right into forgiveness, almost like I forgive you for being human, because I empathize with you, you know. Mm-hmm. giving someone that gift when it feels like they're actively shitting on you.
That can be a challenge.
I could tell a story to answer that question.
Yeah, like how do you get over the part of like deciding someone deserves your empathy?
Drew, you had a story?
So yeah, to try to answer your question, and you were there for this fun story at the dog park. It was like, I remember we were down at Point Isabel, and it was pretty empty. We had our dog, Inferno, and I had a tennis ball, and there was like a dad and a little boy, and they were walking around. They didn't have a dog, but they were at Point Isabel walking around, because dogs are cool. And I mean, I would imagine taking a kid there would be fun to do, regardless if he had a dog or not, but they didn't have a dog. So I kicked a tennis ball and it sliced, meaning it curved to the right unintentionally, and the ball bounced right by the family, and Inferno was on just red alert, must retrieve ball, and he kind of bumped the little boy.
It was obvious it was accidental, and it was watching. It was pretty comical. It was like
the boy spun
around.
There
goes the ball. There's the little boy.
Well, yeah,
here's the dog.
Yeah.
And then they all converged.
We saw it coming. Oh, for a ways off. I was like, oh, he's gonna knock him. There he did.
Yeah.
And he brushed him, and he spun around and fell over.
He was on a little bike. A little.
Is that what happened?
A little pushy trike.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Like a tricycle or a scooter.
A little tricycle.
A tricycle for like a with really big wheels for like a little kid.
Yeah. So the guy turns around and begins immediately yelling, "How dare you? How dare you? How dare you throw this ball so close to my boy? What are you doing? You knew that." And all the time, I'm listening to his words, but more than that, I'm listening to what he's putting out emotionally. Like, I'm making a guess at what I'm thinking he's feeling. And I know that a thing that he probably encounters very often is someone to respond in the way that he's putting out, like someone to match or up his energy level. But I kind of, in some practice, have come around to that doesn't usually get you what you want or what they want, what anybody wants.
Yeah.
So what I did is I calmly listened through the whole thing, and I said back some of the key stuff that he said to make sure he knew that I heard him.
Right. Indicating that you heard him.
Yeah. And I didn't push any agenda. I didn't have any other agenda besides I hoped he was fine.
So you repeated back. You repeated his words back to him.
I repeated his words back to him. And he basically, that's all he really wanted. That's all what that was in between him having his, what looked like anger experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then him, that experience ending, and then him going back to having a good time with his kid. The only thing that was in between that was me just listening, not reacting, reflecting, and then that was really it.
Cool.
He immediately calmed down. He was like confused for a second. I think he might have been confused at why it was it working. Why
How dare you empathize with me?
Yeah. How did that just work the first time ever? And I was like, oh. So, I was looking at it in a sense in that direction, and then that was it. It was over.
Can I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
Because I've seen you, as your partner, I've seen you do this before. There's been multiple instances. Like, there's a time we were in the Whole Foods parking lot near our house, and we parked in such a way that the guy next to us didn't appreciate, but his reaction was as if you had pulled your pants down and just taking a dump on his windshield. Like, literally,
that's how he was reacting.
That was the level of his energy, and it was really, really intense how upset he was. And my question for you is, when someone is coming at you really upset and ready to explain to you how wrong you are. Mm. How do you not punch them in the face? Like, I hear that you then choose, okay, I'm just gonna be empathetic with you, and I hear you're having a hard time, and I'm gonna walk away from this situation. But like, how do you get there? Because I make up that a lot of people never get to the reflecting part. It's just like immediate fist to the mouth. Pop.
Well, he was a small
fuck
man.
Fuck you.
It wouldn't have been very nice of me. And I knew, part of my answer is I knew I was in no real danger. Like if I just grabbed his neck and pushed him on the ground, he'd be done. He was so small. And I don't want to hurt anybody. So I was like, you know, I can tell he's not going to attack me.
Yeah.
So I was like, we'll just leave situation. I literally just turned around and walk away. And he continued shouting, and then we went. It's like, yeah. So how did I get there? It was like, I don't know. I'm basically in that state all the time. It's like, not how do I get there? That's sort of how I live. I'm sort of in the space of all beings to me are doing the best they can with what they have at the time. And my triggering response, like my getting triggered thing and then noticing my experience is now in the same second that I'm noticing that it's happening, that I'm realizing, well, what do I want more? And then I choose that. It's all like in the same second now. Hmm. So yeah, I get triggered like everyone all the time, but I just practiced noticing my experience, realizing that what do I want the most? And how do we get there together?
See, I would call that magic. Honestly, I would call that magic.
Thank you. Thanks for the compliment. I'm blushing.
Yeah, I would call that magic. There's a $1 million, maybe $1 billion. There's a big ol' industry out there that many Californians participate in.
Porno?
Books and seminars and classes and workshops and retreats and podcasts, mm-hmm. and churches all around how to help people do basically that. How to be okay with having someone be in your face being like, you're wrong, and like not feel the need to engage or like prove like, no, you're wrong. You're wronger. Fuck
I'm
you.
Less wrong than you. Yeah. Well, thank you.
That's a good question. Maybe that's a wrap-up question.
Maybe that is the wrap-up question. Wow.
Could you repeat it? Do you remember it?
I don't remember it.
Well, we got it.
How would you? Yeah. How would you deal with someone approaching you that's having a negative and hostile experience?
Yeah, if someone comes up to you and they're yelling, telling you about how you're wrong, and they're just like blown out of their mind how wrong you are, and they're screaming and almost threatening, kind of threatening, cursing, how do you stay calm, don't react?
And get to the point where you can be empathetic with them.
Right.
Let's.
How do you not shoot punch? How do you choose not to punch them in
right.
the face? I think that's how you really
right.
phrased it.
Thanks, Aubrey.
Yeah.
Right. Let's rein the analogy in a little bit. I would say like the main thing that's in danger is your ego. Hmm. Like because when it comes to like someone's physically threatening, I feel like that's some different territory. But when someone is like, you're the wrongest. Yeah. I know you're wrong. I'm going to prove you're wrong. I'm rubbing your face in how wrong you are and how much you've wronged me as a result of your wrongness.
Yeah, good question. Maybe our audience can answer it for us.
Hmm. Thank you.
If we have an audience.
Oh. Well, I did have one more question, if you have time still, for you.
I have as much time as I'm allowed.
Okay.
No time limit.
Okay. I have, no,
well, hard drive space. That's the only time limit.
Okay. Okay.
Just keep emptying the trash.
Wait. No.
Just drag the hard drive. Just drag the hard drive to the trash.
Wait a minute.
All right.
The Bay Area. I want to talk to you. I want to hear about the Bay Area. I'm curious about what you think about Bay Area is. What does it mean? What's here? What isn't here?
I make up that most people near or in a metropolitan area have this feeling of like, oh, this is the place. This is the place. And I feel like being a native Californian and how much California is glamorized in popular culture, it's easy to be like, actually, guys, this is the place.
It kind of is the place, guys. Honest,
yeah. It's the place. I mean, I hear New York is cool. I thought it was like whatever, no. But like, this is the place. And yeah, the Bay Area. There's many things that I really love about the Bay Area. The Bay Area is where I became an adult. Bay Area really opened up a whole world of expression and community and artistic expression to me. That was life-changing for sure. Bay Area has in part made me who I am, being a part of this area. And I'm really grateful for that. As much as I really appreciate the diversity of community here and the amazing opportunities and the like outpouring of cool artistic expression that happens everywhere all the time, there's like always some cool thing to go do. The cost of living as an adult is a super boner jam. Mm-hmm. God, come on.
Boner jam. Yeah.
And I mean, that's been true for some time, but especially recently with how things have been going, it's made it like less and less appealing to think about trying to craft put down roots and craft a life here. Like I feel that I have this like, if I allow myself to go there, I can have a really bittersweet experience, like driving around Berkeley and Albany and seeing all these adorable California bungalow homes that just look so great. And I make up were built when the people who lived in those communities were middle-class Americans, and the people who lived in those homes were the people who owned the businesses in the community, and their kids went to school in the community, and that's just, wow, just not, it doesn't feel true anymore. Like, it's the doctors and lawyers that work in the city that live in those homes, and both of the adults living in the home are both doctors and lawyers. It's like...
It's expensive.
It's...
Especially with the Silicon Valley moving into... San Francisco,
right?
All stuff, the rise of the internet.
I want to live in a place where building a life is accessible.
Just only do it when I talk, Truth. So that's the rule. Okay.
Heard. Little
technical difficulties. I just finished a job where I was the general manager of a restaurant, which, if I had told myself a decade ago, like, you're going to be managing a restaurant, I think that, like, I would have made up that was, like, an official adult job, like, with an official adult money. Like, you can do adult things, like, buy a house, buy proper, like, the things that adults do. And
have vacation, go
right,
places.
Healthcare is covered.
Benefits.
Right.
Vacation.
Maybe not a yacht, but.
Right.
Livable. Maybe a little more than a livable wage.
Right, the basic...
Some spreading around money.
American middle-class dream.
Yeah.
And...
was that not your experience?
Absolutely not. And I mean, I was working for a company that kind of generally across the board underpaid their employees, including me. Like, the going salary rate and benefit package of someone who's in the general management side of restaurant business in the Bay makes about 10 grand more annually than I was making and had benefits that I didn't have. I didn't have any benefits. So part of that was with the company I was with. But even if I was with a different company, it's still like I get to rent my apartment and that's basically it. Like trying to buy a house, even in a farther out community, like it's just not an option.
Yeah.
No way. Our listeners know a little bit about our previous job. We all worked there together.
We did. It's true.
Gratitude.
Well, you know, there's that theory that civilization moves westward, right? So from London. London was once the capital of the world, then it was New York, and then you could say L.A. for a while, and now maybe Tokyo. So do you think you'll move further westward?
Further?
To some coast in the that's further westward?
International coast? Probably not. I don't see myself doing that.
I guess Hawaii would be the other national coast.
Or we could build our own coast in between California and Hawaii.
Here, here. Floatable city.
Floatable city, totally sustainable.
The Cloche Obelisk. We'll talk about that later. Some other episode.
You're ready.
I don't know. I'm a land lover.
Yeah. Probably be in California for a while yet.
I mean, I feel like I have more flexibility. I want to go somewhere where I can actually build a life for myself. That's what I want to do. And I'm open to the possibility that that's not the Bay Area. I'm interested, like, being able to live somewhere within an hour drive of the Bay. That would be cool.
What if there were colonies on the moon set up, water, flora, fauna, ecosystems, biospheres? Would you go there if you knew it was a one-way trip, but you'd get to colonize the moon?
Honestly, probably not. I don't think I'm that person. If my partner was like, we need to do this, I'd probably get behind him.
But it would be a conversation.
I'm really into planet Earth. Like, super, super into planet Earth.
I don't know. Yeah. Starfleet becomes an option. Yeah. We gotta go.
Or if it was like you could be one of the pioneer colonists on this colony. You know, it would be the equivalent of like the pilgrims, right?
Yeah.
Go to the new world and start a life.
I don't know, I'm pretty enamored.
It might bust your balls. And you might die. Or bust your ovaries, whatever the case may be.
Do you think you'd go?
I would go in a heartbeat.
Really, you guys, this is a bit of a tangent, but for the record, like,
this show's all tangents.
I feel like the female equivalent of busting balls is labia.
Busting the labs?
Busting your labia. Yeah, because like...
Labs?
Your labs.
Your labs.
Because...
Quit busting my labs.
If you think about it, the labia would have been balls if the chromosomes had gone another way, you know?
See, I'm learning about female anatomy.
And... Well, actually, more so than balls. They can take a beat. Like, they can get tugged on. I wouldn't necessarily say take a beating, but it's like...
You can tug on them.
You can tug on them.
Tug on them.
And they'll be okay. I mean, they're meant to be stretchable enough for a
higher tug threshold.
Higher tug threshold.
Busting my labes.
Busting my labes.
Yeah.
Labes
so,
and babes.
Officially... I'm glad we've clarified that for the world.
I think that was...
It's been like an awkward, like...
Yeah, if you ever wonder...
Conundrum, I think, for some time now. So, you heard it here first, America.
Thank you, America.
If ever you are wondering what this podcast contributes to the world, I think we have our answer.
So, you were a restaurant manager. You were supposed to be able to have a house. The Bay Area is fucking expensive. then what?
Yeah, I grew up in the Monterey Bay area, Salinas specifically, and I really felt sure that I would not choose to live my life in that area. Like, not interested. The community of Salinas is not one that I feel super represented by. Like, that's a place I want to, like, that's a community I want to be an active member of. But I can totally imagine, in a way that I couldn't have a decade ago, like, getting land a little bit more north of Salinas, like, as far up as the Santa Cruz kind of area, or as far south as, like, Prunedale, the Dale of Prunes.
You wouldn't go more north than San Francisco? You wouldn't go to...
I, you know, the thought of living in Sebastopol sounds really nice to me. I don't know how reasonable it is to think that I could build an adult life there either. It's like, might be also prohibitively expensive. Yeah, so I guess I appreciate all of the, it's like, if the Bay feels like this strange mix to me currently, and like where I'm at in my life, of like this bevy of opportunity and this like absolutely not at the same time. Like, so many cool opportunities and so many really distressing limitations because of the way the economy looks. Like, so many people being forced out of their homes. It's hard.
Forced out, bought out, pushed out. Yeah. Well, I lived in the Bay Area as often as I could. I was born in the Bay Area, and I left for high school, and I spent time in Chicago and Baltimore. But the Bay Area is always the coolest to me. Would you have a summary about the Bay Area, Aubrey? What would you say about that?
Well, you know, high diversity, highly politicized atmosphere. There's activists every square millimeter. And you know, it has kind of a liberal, has the perception as being a liberal area, but I find it to be pretty conservative. When you get down to it. Person to person, you know. So, but it's, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. It's kind of the nexus for a lot of things, intellectual and spiritual and political.
That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. I mean, I've been here for 10 years, 11 years, something like that. So I must like it, right?
I guess.
Yeah. Cool. So I think that's our episode, guys.
I think that's it. I think we just finished the episode 6, the
podcast episode 6
for Empathy and Imagination,
with our special guest Rebecca Ainsworth.
Special thank you.
Thanks for showing up. Thanks for making the journey.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to all the listeners. I'd like to acknowledge you all for taking the time to listen to this podcast. See you soon.
See you soon.
way to spend our Saturday night, you know? We're cool.
High five.
You guys are cool. You guys are really cool.